Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and if you go to my website, rusjournal.org, that's R-U-S journal.org, you will, essentially it's a list of everything I've ever done. And it also includes a way to donate to this project. You see, I'm not, because I have people who support me, I'm completely free. I'm not beholden to an institution or a church or anything like that. I am absolutely free in terms of what topics I talk about and what I write about. I can't be doxed. My name, address, and everything else has been public as long as there's been an internet. I just don't care. And that's because people have given and supported my work. And I ask you to continue to do that. For those of you who've benefited from this over years for free, I ask you to continue to assist me as much as humanly possible as things get more and more difficult for us. The alternative, of course, is the fool Callistos Ware, who has come out in favor of homosexual marriages recently. And he does this because he's dependent on institutions. Institutions have to make compromises to function in this world or they'll be destroyed. Having actually independent researchers, there's no foundation or university or church or anything else, I say what I please. And I will always say what I please. I'd rather live in dire poverty than to live the life of a Callistos Ware who believes what he has no choice but to believe. And today I want to talk about someone else who, although I think is more respectable, the Cyprianite Metropolitan Chrysostom. I want to talk about an article he wrote some years ago. It's an old article, 1981. As far as I know, he still accepts it. And the topic here is the male priesthood. Because I could say what I please, thanks to my listeners, I don't worry about offending anyone. I don't care. In fact, I enjoy it. But when I see an obvious case of toadyism, an intellectual cowardice, like Chrysostom has laid out in that article, and as far as I know, still defends, I thank God for the fact that I'm able to be this free. So the concept here is that Orthodox priests, of course, have to be males. And in practical terms, this is because women are less rational and far more changeable than men are. Women are insane for at least a week out of the month. So I'm not sure how any power in their hands is rational. And notice when I say rational, I'm not talking about logic. You know, my cat can use logic as it chases a mouse, albeit poorly in their case. They know what works and what doesn't. That's not what I'm talking about. Reason isn't the same as logic or rationalization after the fact. This has nothing to do with intelligence even, but it has to do with emotional regulation. Women are biological creatures. Men are spiritual creatures. And it's really pitiable to read Orthodox prelates justifying a male priesthood while at the same time trying with every fiber of their being to avoid offending women. Now, many of you have already noticed something, and that is that the church fathers go out the window whenever something politically incorrect comes up. The patristic consensus is ignored whenever it comes to offending a powerful group, whether it be Jews or women or whatever it is. But the argument I'm presenting here, and what I've always presented, the patristic consensus agrees with me 100%. But when it comes to economics, usury, women, the traditionalists throw the church fathers out the window. And normally they'll talk about the fathers only in harmless issues. Issues that don't offend anybody. In other words, they're phonies. Now, I've learned a lot from the Kyprianite group. At least in America, they have, I think, 4 parishes. Tons of money and no people. I don't know how that is. But I've learned a lot from them. They're good writers. They struggle to be mainstream, oddly enough, even though by definition, we're on the fringes of society. And traditionalist Orthodox usually are on the fringes of society. The Kyprianites, in America at least, seem to be an exception. The late Metropolitan Kyprian himself was a fabulously wealthy man. But in America, they have the very impressive Center for Traditionalist Orthodox Studies, which is certainly a worthwhile institution, except I'm not sure how they could be connected with major names in academia. With very few people, how they have the kind of mainstream acceptance that they do. Mainstream acceptance, academic respectability, money, no people. I don't know. I'm suspicious. Nevertheless, regardless of whatever the cause of that is, that kind of respectability comes at a price. And they all know this. And people like that realize this. The world loves them too much. When you see someone, the world seems to support them in many key important ways, you got to wonder. So, Metropolitan, at the time he was Archbishop Chrysostom, he says this, and this is really, this is pretty bad, but this is what he says, and as far as I know, still defends. He pompously says, "Shame, hence each one who proclaims that either the man or a woman superior, or pretends to know the proper role and nature of each. This is arrogance and moderation, intellectual pomposity, and the usurpation of judgments which only God can make. In true spirituality, distinctions both formal and informal disappear." I'll let that garbage sink in for a minute. Those are the words of a coward. Now, these lines are even more inexcusable, since superiority has never been the issue here. Although a few of the church fathers do use the term. Metropolitan Chrysostomos in this article is precisely intellectually pompous. And of course throws judgments around against people who have far less power than he does. Now, Metropolitan Chrysostom is actually quite rational and intelligent, and is solid on 99% of what he talks about. But this is odd, because this is a very feminine, hyper-emotional argument, which was very foreign to him. What I'm saying here makes no claim to superiority. Of course, superiority has to be contextualized, and superiority in what? But we're only interpreting facts here, however inconvenient they might be. But it's common in discussions on race or gender to throw out the word supremacist for the sake of emotional impact. And it also suggests that the speaker has a very bad case. But this uncharacteristic outburst of emotion seems to be designed, and I believe it is designed, to show the ruling class how harmless he is. A neologism for this is virtue signaling. In other words, while he is an Orthodox traditionalist on most things, he accepts the regime consensus on almost all non-religious issues. But he shows this kind of emotionalism on no other topic and in no other forum. Now, I have to admit, and I have to grant, that where women are involved, men most of the time sound like idiots. I mean, no one's innocent of that. But even for a good monk like him, the desire for female approval still weighs heavy upon us, and it's in our DNA. He is a normal man in that sense. Now, I read his article. It came out initially in Orthodox Life in 1981, and has been reprinted in books published by the center. And I read it several times only because I'm trying to figure out if there's really any content. The article says very little, except that his version of the church believes in the equality of the sexes, which is a concept totally unknown to the fathers. Not only the fathers, but unknown to any non-modern society. That this kind of mathematical equality could be applied to human behavior is a mockery. And I'm shocked because he never writes like this on any other topic. So claiming to shed some light onto the role of women in the church, he avoids every major issue and refuses to address the main questions he promises to answer. And wisely, of course, he refuses to cite any sources because he can't, which also is an uncharacteristic trait, something that he does nowhere else. Now, this article was done in 1981. This was long before the utter matriarchy, gynocracy that we live under today, so it's even less excusable. So let me continue here with something he says, which, you know, it gets worse. He says this: indeed, these arguments regarding women are faulty. In the first place, there is nothing at all truly traditional about assigning a certain nature to women. True it is, many of the great ascetic fathers warned monks about the wiles of Eve that exist in the female character. But the counterpart of this is the submission of the male counterpart of Adam in sinning monks. Yet in no sense do we attribute to males a certain nature as such when we defend or define their social roles. Not a syllable of that is true. In fact, it shows such a poor understanding of the ancient world that sometimes I wonder if he actually wrote it. I've never read, including for one of my own people, a paragraph that has more incorrect statements crammed into it than this. The entire ancient method of thought was based around natures. Natures or forms or archetypes. Eternal definitions of things. Now, unlike Chrysostomus, I will cite a few sources. John Chrysostom has a homily, a very famous homily, called The Kind of Women to be Taken as Wives. The very namesake of Metropolitan. And he says the following: God maintained the order of each sex by dividing the business of life into two parts, and assigned the more necessary and beneficial aspects to the man, and the less important, inferior matter to the woman. So St. John not only says that there are specific natures, but these natures, of course, correspond with specific functions within society. He goes on to say, but a companion was made for him, one with a nature far different from his, as the moon is from the sun. You hear the word nature in there. You can't get a clearer statement than this. References to a woman's nature are found in canons and hymns, patristic writings, everywhere. And he knows this, and he knew it at the time. Gregory the Theologian calls women self-indulgent by nature. Cyril Alexandria says that by nature, a woman's understanding is defective. 1 Peter 3 makes reference to it as well. But Platon Chrysostomus is an expert in these areas. He's well aware of the Church Fathers, and he knows that they say this and that they use precisely in English terms like nature. So why does he say it? Why does he say something he knows to be false? But I'm not finished, because St. Ambrose rebukes him even more. Adam was deceived by Eve, he says, not Eve by Adam. It's right that he, whom that woman induced to sin, should assume the role of guide lest he fall again through feminine instability. And that is exactly why women can't be priests. And it's a rare woman who will deny it. Now, when you read this article of his, of course, the door is wide open for a women priest. Because he doesn't give a single reason as to why the priesthood, the diaconate, New Orthodox Church, anything, these offices are, should be just male. He doesn't give a single reason. He doesn't offer a single bit of insight. And I'm telling you that this is not a coincidence. This is not, I mean, this is by design. And most traditionalists will do this because they fear stating the obvious. Now, you can have a priestess in a pagan cult because the pagan cults weren't religions. They weren't creeds. Their doctrines change all the time. When you're talking about a Dionysian cult, the female mind is exactly what that kind of cult would require. Emotional, changeable, rationalizing, biological. But Christianity is quite the opposite of that. So you had priestesses in those kind of cults because their natures fit precisely what a Dionysian mentality would require. Chrysostomus is willing to place his soul in danger to placate women. And I have some sympathy for him. I have sympathy for him because this is something that men desire. This is, you know, to irritate women is something that men fear. Well, men other than me, because I don't care. But normal guys with a normal life who aren't hermits do fear this, and they worry about it. Well, I'm not finished yet. St. Gregory the Dialogist, St. Gregory, Pope Gregory the First, Pope of Rome, says, "Woman is slow in understanding, and her unstable and naive mind renders her, by way of natural weakness, to the necessity of a strong hand in her husband. Her use is twofold, sex and motherhood." There is yet another unflattering reference to a female nature, and an undeniable truth. St. Augustine, he goes even further. He says, "Woman does not possess the image of God in herself, but only when taken together with the male who is her head, so that the whole substance is one image. But when she is assigned the role of helpmate, a function that pertains to her alone, to her nature alone, then she is not the image of God. But as far as a man is concerned, he is by himself alone the image of God, just as fully and completely as when he and the woman are joined together into one." And that's probably the most extreme statement that you're going to find. The way the ancients understood numbers, and I've mentioned this before, I lectured on this at universities, this is a way to understand the medieval mentality, is that numbers are gendered, they're icons, and specifically the numbers 1 and the number 2. Number one is always is unity. It's the unknowable one, the origin of all things. It's always male, alpha, and it pertains to heaven and reason. Number two pertains to the earth. It's biological. It's always female. Now Augustine here, he's not saying that women don't have souls, but he is rejecting, and it has to be understood in the context that there is no such thing as a modern individual. He's not talking about women as people, because taking an individual in the abstract didn't exist in the ancient world. It's an absurdity. The basic unit of society, which couldn't be divided any further, is the extended family. But, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, following the fathers exists really only when it's convenient. And I want to direct the Metropolitan to the work Holy Mothers of Orthodoxy, Women in the Church. It was published by Light and Life, Eva Topping, in 1987. That has a full list of the Church Fathers and concerning precisely female nature and what it is and how the nature corresponds to personality traits and, in addition, her role in society and her role in general. Traditionalist bishops, of which there are far too many, of course, because every, you know, there's a million jurisdictions, they become raving modernists when economic questions arise, for example. They'll condemn masturbation to the skies, but usury is accepted as a fait accompli. They love the Church Fathers when it's easy. But when they condemn the basic institutions of modernity, you know, St. Ambrose condemns all private property, for example, all of a sudden they're uninteresting. But let's talk about his namesake even further. St. John Chrysostom says this: "It does not profit a man to marry. For what is a woman but an enemy of friendship, an inescapable punishment, a necessary evil, a natural temptation, a domestic danger, delectable mischief, a fault in nature, painted with beautiful colors? The whole of her body is nothing less than phlegm, blood, bile, rheum, and the fluid of digested food. If you consider what is stored up behind those lovely eyes, the angle of the nose, the mouth, and the cheeks, you'll agree that the well-proportioned body is only a whitened sepulcher." Now, there's a lot of truth to this. Normal men will be attracted to beautiful women, sometimes even average women. One way to understand this is that that's mostly in our heads. What St. John is saying here is that, of course, we get men are the same way. What he's saying here is that this body really is nothing special. It's just blood, bile, the fluid of digested food. What makes up those eyes? What makes up these, you know, the curves of her body, or what exactly? And what is she going to look like in a few years or in the grave? And yet this is what we give up our lives for. Domestic danger. You know, I've learned that the hard way. Delectable mischief. And that they're painted. In other words, they wear a mask for us. And then at some point, the mask comes off. By that time, you're in love with them. There's not much you can do. Now, the males who are listening to this know exactly what I'm talking about. The betas out there and Captain Savaho and all this, these guys are going to pretend not to know, but you know, because you've been the victim of it. The power of the female form makes St. John's words hard to come to mind. Women have profited handsomely from being such a sepulcher. Now, it makes me laugh when sometimes when someone has run out of arguments, they'll say this is taken out of context. Now, what in the hell context could this possibly be a part of that would reject its plain meaning? That phrase is used so much in public debate that it's become maddening. It no longer has meaning. What context could negate the plain meaning of these words? I know exactly the context of these words, the intellectual context from which they come, and the nature of these fathers themselves. If anything, they amplify the plain meaning that we're talking about here. St. John even goes further than this. And in this case, the quote I just mentioned is a discourse on Genesis, and the one coming up here is concerning the priesthood, book 2. And if they would learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home. "Thus, not only, as it seems, are they not allowed to speak," says he, "at random, but even to ask a question in church." Now, if they ought not to ask questions, much more as they're speaking at pleasure contrary to law. What may be the cause of this setting them under so great subjection? Because a woman is in some sort of weaker being, easily carried away and light-minded. Here you see why he is set over them, their husbands as teachers, for the benefit of both. Or so he both rendered the woman orderly, and the husbands he made anxious, as having to deliver to their wives very exactly what they heard. See, the definition of a husband is someone who takes care of something. It's another word for farmer. This is why males are usually older than their wives. It's there for education and discipline. No one can deny that without a strong father figure, women go insane. They become whores. They destroy themselves. I'll take you to any college campus and I'll show you exactly how it's done. More than one of my students has told me that a full third of the women in the campuses that I've taught at are bulimic, are cutters, or self-mutilators. And yet they're worshipped. They believe being lonely is to have fewer than 10 beta orbiters. They've profited handsomely, but like with everything else, it comes at a price. Those bodies come at a price. So men, when you kiss one of these women, what are you sticking your tongue into if she's been throwing up? It all comes at a price. Well, unfortunately for Metropolitan Chrysostomus, his namesake does use the word superiority over and over and over and over again. In fact, all the fathers do. Women are eternally troublesome to men. They extract resources. They manipulate them. Their ability to manipulate man's self-esteem gives them power that no dictator could ever dream of, because this isn't political power. This is a psychological power. The book of Proverbs talks about how rare a good woman is, but when you find her, she is worth all the money in the world. But a good woman usually has a good father and a good husband, or something like that. The great Mother Anna, who passed away a few years ago, in the Serbian monastery in Cleveland, who I knew very well, understood all of this. And she had a tremendous amount of self-discipline. She was well aware of this and really was the person who kind of brought these arguments to my attention. This is why women can't be priests, because Christianity is not a Dionysian cult. The female mind is perfectly suited to the rites of Dionysius or Bacchus. The Maenads, who tear apart men, or the sirens who lure sailors in to the point where we all know the story. It's impossible to say no. When I talk to young men about this, I say, you've not been in love before, have you? And if you haven't, then shut up and listen. Because the power, and when you fall out of love again, and you think about what you realize what a moron you've been, it is no different than a drug addiction. It boosts your self-esteem. It gives you a high like nothing else. But like everything else, it comes at a price. And you look back on your behavior. It's kind of like being drunk and you wake up the next morning and you say, oh my God, what did I do? And I've said this before, but what is a witch? The ancient and medieval concept of a witch is a attractive young woman without a family. That's what they all are. The magic that they perform is exactly what I'm talking about. They have to exist parasitically off a man. And so they attach themselves to one. She seems to be totally liberated. And this man, who did not marry for something, no one married for romantic reasons back then, they married for economic reasons or family reasons. This woman is beautiful. He's never been manipulated this way before. He has no defenses. And the guy does anything and everything to please her. He'll abandon his family. He'll abandon his children. He'll quit his job. He'll destroy himself. He'll spend every penny he has on her. So you might excuse the ancients to say the man has had some sort of spell put on him. And we still use that phraseology. She's put a spell on him. How many love songs mention this? That's what they're talking. That's what a witch is. Now they're depicted as old ladies, ugly old ladies, because that's what they are on the inside. It's not meant to be a realistic picture. It's their behavior. But a witch was always young, always attractive, always female, and didn't have the normal attachments that a woman had. And she was a huge threat to women in the neighborhood. And she came in, and the men of the area would go bonkers. And she knew how to manipulate them. And she lived parasitically off them. This is why they were burned. Because they were a massive threat. They could destroy an entire neighborhood. That's what a witch is. That's what magic refers to. It's the full control over these chemical reactions. Man's self-esteem. An older, a middle-aged man, an 18-year-old witch comes on to him for some financial purpose, and he goes, he can't believe it. His ego is boosted beyond belief. He's high. He's no different than any other drug, and every man who's listening to me knows what I'm talking about. So one of these people coming into a neighborhood or a village could destroy it. This is why the people screaming for the murder of the witches were women. Married women. Older women. They were threatened, as well they should be. Because on her own, the woman is completely amoral. She is a biological creature, not a rational creature. And they knew this. They were threatened for very, very good reason. And they demanded either her banishment or her execution. And because they tempt men with the same fantasy that demons use, showing images rather than realities, and men drunkenly chase after this fantasy rather than reality and destroy their families in the process, they're associated with demons. That's because they are. This is exactly what St. Augustine and St. John Chrysostom are talking about. It was so bizarre to find a woman without a family because the abstract individual didn't exist. They were freaks. There was no individual in the ancient world or the medieval world or even the early modern world. Only in our era is there such a thing as an individual. Individuals can't exist on their own. And that's proof of it because this woman had to attach herself to the married men, the older, more successful men in the area, usually more than one. Not being used to that, the man was very susceptible to that. Middle-aged men were destroying their lives for the sake of pleasing her. And the women of the neighborhood would get together and kill her. And it's hard to blame them. This is exactly what we're talking about. That's what a witch is. It's not some old lady who poisons an apple. That's how they're depicted, because how men behave is very much akin to having a spell put on them. It's very similar to having what we would call some magical act. It's not magic. I mean, it's very practical. But it certainly seems that way to the outsider. And when it's over, and the man comes to his senses, it's no different than when you wake up after a night of drinking and you say, oh my God, what did I do? And if you haven't been through that, then you're not a normal man. There's something wrong with you. Or maybe you're too young. We've all done it. Now, the thesis that I'm arguing here, which is the pure patristic thesis with no deviation, I mean, no one disagrees with this in the ancient world, is that women are irrational, and that their body chemistry, motives, and thought processes render their reason to be far weaker than a man. Women are far more apt to use images rather than propositions in an argument. Now, attractive women in today's world get away with it for obvious reasons. They get away with whatever they want. I mean, a beautiful woman constantly receiving attention from men has no reason to cultivate logic or really do much of anything. She need cultivate nothing other than her knowledge of anatomy. We've all seen this. We've seen men throw money at these people. Why would they bother working? Why would they bother caring? It's not, you know, why do work you don't have to do? Attractive women surrounded by beta orbiters, which is essentially an army of servants, never has to deal with problems head on. She has people working for her. A beta orbiter is someone who she really doesn't want, but who really wants her. A weak sort of man who will do anything for a little bit of attention. And if she asks one of them to do something, no matter what it is, he'll do it. A beautiful woman has 10, 20, 30 of these. So then what problem could she possibly have? And how could she ever be held accountable for anything? So then, naturally, even today, you have an atrophied rational faculty. So the privileged world of the attractive female today is such that she has an army of men to say yes to even her most absurd delusions. You've seen this. Well, the Metropolitan doesn't know what a beta orbiter is, that he shouldn't be talking about these issues. But image thinking is very important. It has a role, of course. It's not based on linear logic at all. Linear logic is very easy. We say A causes B, B causes C, therefore A causes C. Basically, that's the simple design. All thinking implies it. An image is different. We're not talking about causality here. We're talking about a mental picture, usually with an emotion attached to it, or image of something, someone's image. If something doesn't adhere to that image, it can't be true. It might be factually true. If it doesn't cohere to the image of somebody, oh, he could never do something like that, kind of arguments. But linear has a tendency to be the male domain. Image thinking is the female domain. Now, image thinking often does have, I mean, we have icons in orthodoxy. Image thinking has a lot to do with how we function. It does have a place. I'm not saying that this is a matter of intellectual inferiority. But when it comes to the use of reason, it most certainly is. Now, because of the emotional outbursts that such a moderate and ancient argument will evoke, I want to reassure you guys that, you know, image thinking isn't a judgment of intelligence at all. But it is why women can't be in any leadership role. It's not a value judgment, in other words. Image thinking is neither above or below reason. Something can be irrational, but be greater than reason. Like intuition. To say that women are less rational than men is to say that their stability is lacking. They're changeable. And yet, adherence to unchanging, strict doctrine is the very first quality of a priest. It's the last thing that typifies a woman. A woman priest would be miserable unless she wasn't able to change doctrine as she saw fit. By the way, changing doctrine is usually the first order of business for these groups demanding female priests. That's not an accident. But what does science have to say about this? Usually, debates over this are purely emotional, because that's how you convince someone you're rational. Evidence never really matters. But it has to be explained regardless. The consensus today is that early in the brain's gestation, the division is between the brain's two hemispheres, and it's very different for the two sexes. The divider between the two hemispheres, corpus callosum, is stronger and larger in the male than the female brain, which shouldn't be a surprise. The caudate nucleus in males is larger too. That's the structure that processes memory logically. And the gender differences in these two structures is of immense significance. So yeah, the science is on the side of the Church Fathers here. K.P. Bishop in 1997 in the journal Neuroscience and Behavior Review was forced to come to this conclusion, and it's a very common conclusion. It's comic to watch male researchers in terror when they stumble upon this fact. They try to cover up their feelings by maybe randomly condemning sexism out of the blue or firing a male intern or something like that. American researchers in academia live in fear, in terror, of being called racist or sexist or something like that. So it shouldn't surprise you that the major contributions in this field come from China. They don't care. There's an article called Sex-Related Neuroanatomical Basis of Emotional Regulation Ability, which is at the Beijing University, which is not under the anti-intellectual structures of modern feminism. But here's what he has to say, and this is a meta-study of thousands of brains and thousands of previous works on the subject. He says this: as expected, males significantly scored higher in emotion regulation ability than females. More importantly, We found sex differences in the neuroanatomical basis of emotion regulation ability. Males showed a stronger positive relation between emotion regulation ability and regional gray matter volume in the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. In contrast, females demonstrated a stronger positive relation between emotion regulation ability and GMV in an anatomical cluster that extends from the left brainstem to the left hippocampus, left amygdala and the insular cortex. Well, it's the same argument, arguing that the connection between hemispheric variability and emotional regulation is demonstrated over and over and over again, even in American neuroscience. Now, the Chinese will bring out the very politically incorrect conclusion. The American researchers won't do that. Baron Cohen's 2002, The Extreme Male Brain Theory of Autism, comes to the exact same conclusion. But because these are highly specialized and technical fields, the social impact here is minimal. G. Domes and Schultz et al. 2010, the article, The Neural Correlates of Sex Differences in Emotional Reactivity and Emotional Regulation, also agrees with the Chinese study. The imagery studies here are usually very expensive to conduct and are limited only to the largest of universities, so that only increases the importance of the Chinese study. That emotional regulation in women is always inferior, with very few exceptions. As to be expected, though, the damage control has been done and vague attacks on their methodology have already been published to save careers. This is just academic virtue signaling. The irrationality of women is an established fact and experience, universal cultural history, and now the use of the most advanced imaging techniques the world over. This is why women can't be priests. The British Daily Mail ran the story. Even when given every possible encouragement, female soldiers were not mentally as strong as males. They crack under pressure. Now, this isn't a statement of intelligence either. It is a statement of stability. Intelligence is not really the issue because it's too vague. Emotional regulation is very specific. That is the issue here. And that has been replicated in militaries and police departments the world over. The chemical CRF, or the hormone that comes with negative stress. Dr. Rita Valentino, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, did research on this because she's female, she kind of got away with it. And she writes, but researchers already know that CRF regulation is disrupted in stress-related psychiatric disorders. So this research may be relevant to underlying human biology, may help explain why women are twice as vulnerable as men to stress-related disorders. Well, women can't be priests because they're emotionally unstable. Yet again, science supports the ancient consensus. And given the amount of pressure on scientists, at least in America, to deny those conclusions, the fact that they come out anyway just amplifies the truth of the matter. Now, let's be clear here. Ideally, the priesthood is a position of authority. Now, many of us who've been involved in Slavic parishes in America realize, though, that men don't run these churches. The older babushkas do. They are the force for conservatism, not the rational male. This is where iconic thought is quite appropriate. Women dominate parishes. And every Slavic parish I've ever been to, women dominated. Mother Anna dominated Bishop Mitrofan over many issues. So then what's the issue? So why is this even a question then if that's the case? Christ was surrounded by females. One of the strongest evidence for the veracity of the resurrection is that it was first proclaimed by females. At the time, a woman's testimony wasn't permitted in court. So why would the writers of the Gospels mention that the first witnesses of the resurrection were women? Women stayed by Christ's side at the cross while the apostles hid themselves. Women were his most vocal supporters. But even with all that, Christ only made men clergy, apostles, or disciples. Because they refused to think logically, it was the women who stood firm, and the apostles ran and hid. The same instability to control emotional states that makes women unfit to be clergy made them withstand the fear that dominated the apostles. their loyalty and communal focus allowed them to stand firm while the logical apostles were saving their own skin. Their emotionalism in this case was for the good, while the reasonable male brain was for the evil in this case. Male rationality, in other words, has to be checked by the emotions of his mate. One can't function without the other. What people don't realize is that the married priesthood in the Orthodox Church already means that the priest's wife shares in his ministry. She bakes the communion bread, which is the first step in his consecration. If marriage makes one flesh, then women are priests to that extent. But modern individualism, which is soaked in the sexual revolution, rejects the one flesh idea anyway, and sees marriage as an outdated phenomenon. Husband and wife, in their minds, are still two isolated individuals, and they've come together for some utilitarian purpose. But Orthodox patristic thinking, all ancient thinking, in fact, rejects the superficiality. Reason itself rejects it. The Roman Catholic cardinal, Mauro Pacenza, he says this: "The Church isn't a political government in which it is right to demand adequate representation. The Church is something different. The Church is the body of Christ, and in her, each one is a part according to what Christ has established." This is an excellent argument, and it highlights the total misunderstanding of the Church in the mind of modernists. And he was asked the following. He was asked, "But could someone really participate in the life of the Church without having effective power and responsibility?" That's a stupid question. And he responded this way: "Who said that participation in the life of the Church is a question of power? If this were the case, we would unmask the real equivocation in conceiving the Church herself not as she is, human and divine, but simply as one of the many human associations. Maybe the greatest and most noble, given her history, she would then have to be administered by division of power." That's a pretty brilliant response. The demand for female priests is not about the Church at all. It's about a false and distorted image of it. The arguments of the feminists writing on these matters are merely about power only. As if to underscore their irrationality, an Irish feminist wrote recently concerning a papal decision to bar women from the diaconate. She says this: "The bishops were free to act independently of Rome, for they were not under pressure to implement the permanent diaconate. However, they chose to reinforce the caste system in the Church by strengthening the clerical order." This over-the-top rhetoric is common among feminist authors. It doesn't even make sense. It's raw emotion. Because Rome has stated they will maintain the all-male diaconate, the Church thus is said to mimic the Hindu caste system. The title of her piece is, "Once again, women are being cast out of the Catholic Church." Even the title is overflowing with emotion. At no time are women cast out of the Church because they can't be deacons. That article alone makes the point here. She continues, "I call on the women and men of Ireland to stand in solidarity with theologically educated women and refuse to accept male deacons. Do not collude in your own oppression." Well, I don't think she realizes it, but she made the case for an all-male clergy. I wonder what she means by theologically educated. The Church Fathers certainly have spoken on the issue long ago. A beta theologian, Robert Hovoda. These guys, they have a tendency to use overly academic language to make very simple points. And he's one of these idiots searching for male approval. And he says this: "One must say, therefore, even if it were possible to separate the head from the body, and to seek to make perceptible and recognizable in the ministry of bishop or presbyter only in the head, the incarnate word, the male person is inadequate to the full reality which faith contemplates. Sacrament of initiation, baptism, confirmation, Eucharist, are the most obvious indication of where faith stands on the issue of its identification with Christ." His point is simply that Christ is not fully understood in the Church without full female participation, but participation is identical with the polity of a unisex priesthood. The argument is wildly illogical and makes a huge number of unwarranted assumptions, but it's not atypical of this movement. Even the terms aren't defined properly. He partakes of the same illogical, over-emotional rhetoric of women in general on these issues. The male feminist is really a sorry specimen. Mary Hunt, who's well known amongst Catholics as a feminist author, says this: The no is more to members of the clerical caste, even women, who are set aside for a specific function. While for some clerics this has meant access to ecclesiastical power, women know that being set apart really means being marginalized. Most male clergy have felt the same way, being told that they should not participate in politics, that they should not have an emotional, relational life, that their social role is to keep the sanctuary lights burning. Such marginalization would be nothing new for women. I strongly advise against accepting it as a price for full ministry, while ministers of the gospel belong in the world. The argument is the collapse of the church. In Catholic or Orthodox, it doesn't matter. The arguments are identical in each case. Here, caste and power are the dominant words, showing the emotional nature of the logic. You see, emotional rhetoric takes a small amount of evidence and turns it into an avalanche of assumed proof. Now, one can minister the gospel without being a priest, as Hunt well knows. But the gospel that she's promoting has no relation to the books of the Bible. She argues for a clerical sexuality unfettered by guilt and utters such vague and trite slogans. But the arguments of this movement are precisely why women can't be priests. This is thought theorizing. This is pseudo-intellectualism. And really, it's the domain of upper-class male university professors and those trying to be like them. Theological rhetoric, and I could cite hundreds of examples of this, just purely illogical rhetoric, and as I say rhetoric deliberately, it's not reasoned argument. But this kind of illogic is one of the reasons why hierarchy exists. It's to keep the pseudo-intellectual, overly emotional, and obsessionally fashion-conscious as far away as possible from the altar. To argue that female authors are exceptionally emotional leads to a predictable set of intensely emotional outbursts as a refutation. And they can't see the irony in that. How many of you have had a woman scream in your face that we're just as rational as you are? And when you laugh at that, it gets them even angrier because they can't see why that's a problem, how that doesn't make sense. Now, I've mentioned some of this before, but the demand for female priests is connected to a hatred of the church. It's not the church that we go to that they're talking about. The church is merely a matter of power, just like any other human institution. So in their arguments, they prove why the priesthood in the hierarchy has to be male. Sexuality is a woman's primary weapon. It's the primary form of their domination and control over the male ego. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Attractive women rule men without mercy. Access to the bedroom and the pitiable control of male self-esteem. These are well-known and painful levers of irresponsible domination. Every single man hearing this knows what I'm talking about. Harvard Business Review recently wrote that women control upwards of 90 trillion yearly in economic power the world over. Women make the decisions and the purchases of 94% of home furnishings, 92% of vacations, 91% of homes, 60% of automobiles, and 51% of consumer electronics. But how much of this have they earned? That means the American economy is female controlled. The same article says that about half of all future economic growth in the U.S. will be directly controlled by women. Not caused by them, but controlled by them. Given the existence of female networks, government grants, and social force, over half the new businesses in the U.S. are controlled by women. Women control 70% of the consumer spending on the planet, at least, and they own over 40% of America's businesses. Now, they own 40%. It doesn't say how much they can control. Women control the majority of the wealth in American businesses today. Male earnings have not risen in 30 years. The cost of living and the number of things people are forced to spend money on means that men are becoming poor and quickly. Women's earnings have risen over 35% since 1979. 7/8 of the layoffs since that very same year have been male. Most college students today are female. Most graduate degrees are awarded to female. And of all the management positions in the USA, over half are occupied by women. Importantly, though, formal positions of power don't tell the whole story. What matters is the control over self-identification, ego gratification, self-esteem, self-image. This is a woman's field. This isn't about gaining power. It's about defending power. The point I'm trying to make is the domination of women has an economic foundation in the sense that as divorce becomes easier to get, and divorce is a massive wealth transfer from men to women, this, you know, after your first divorce, a woman finds her second career because then she's given the capital and the money to begin working for herself. So the domination of females over businesses has far more to do with what she took from her husband than anything else. David Stove, who is a philosopher at the University of Sydney, and he's trying to make sense out of the female argument of oppression. He's talking about the utter universality of women's roles being nurturing, family-based roles. Can it be an accident? And he says this: the feminist has to offer some definite explanation as to why the intellectual capacity of women has so consistently met with obstacles it could not overcome. And his explanation has to be one which is consistent with the equality theory. In other words, that the genders are the same intellectually. It wouldn't be any good to say, for example, the main interfering factor has been the aggressiveness, sexual exclusiveness, superior cunning of males. Because this suggestion by itself is not without merit. But those things are definite and detectable things. And they do operate in males and do impede to some extent intellectual performance of women. But of course, the suggestion is not one that the equalitarians can adopt, since to ascribe superior cunning to males is to contradict the very intellectual quality for which he contends. In other words, the fact that women have men have consistently, without fail, intellectually kept women in their place, no matter what women have done, it can't be a matter of intellectual superiority. So then why? It's very hard to refute. The main reason why, he says the following. He says, the main reason why I believe, and the main reason why nearly everyone always has believed, that the intellectual capacity of women is inferior to that of men is just this: that the intellectual performance of women is inferior to that of men. In other words, if women were man's equal, men would not be able to subject them to their position for millennia and then convince them it's perfectly natural. But suddenly in 1970, men realized we're all the same. Now, I don't usually use the harsh language that Roe uses here. You know, words like intellectual inferiority are not words that I normally use, and I don't accept that in the very broad sense that he's using it. But the general argument is irrefutable. Therefore, women have used networking, divorce, sexuality, the state, rather than reason, to dominate men. Therefore, the American male is facing a matriarchy of massive proportion, and his power is being wielded by those with no control over their emotions. The Women's March last year, whenever it was, proved the utter dominance of emotionalism in feminist thinking. They dressed up in vagina costumes. And they dressed up in vagina costumes to protest their image as being over-theatrical and emotional. In fact, I don't even know what the Vagina March was for. Well, we know who runs the show. We know that George Soros financed this. We also realize that the big foundations also financed the women priest movement. I mean, we know that feminism came into existence in 1970 because that's when men made the most money. Bringing women to the workforce meant that wages fell. Stalin had his own feminist movement in the 1930s to deal with the labor shortage in his crash industrialization program. Feminism is a creation of men and is maintained by them. Men have been the authors of this, not women. And it's because men seek the approval of females, but females loathe men who seek their good graces. The disastrous article by Chrysostomos was another one of these toadying attempts to gain female approval. is very poor and over-emotional form of virtue signaling, very much unlike his later work, and it is embarrassing. It's an attempt to gain approval from the establishment to show the world he's not an extremist. But the truth is that women can't be priests because they're not as capable as men in the use of reason in the sense of emotional regulation. Because of their instability, they've been universally granted a restricted place in society. But their power today in American society is totalitarian and it's getting worse. And articles like the one Metropolitan Chrysostomus has put out isn't helping anybody. It's toadying. It's nonsense. It has no basis in science. It has no basis in theology. It has no basis in patristic thinking. It has no basis in reason. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.